In ancient Rome, when a victorious general paraded through the streets, legend has it that he was sometimes trailed by a servant whose job it was to repeat to him, "Memento mori," remember, you will die. A reminder of mortality would help the hero keep things in perspective, instill some humility. Jobs's memento mori had been delivered by his doctors, but it did not instill humility. Instead, he roared back after his recovery with even more passion. The illness reminded him that he had nothing to lose, so he should forge ahead full speed. "He came back on a mission," said Cook. Even though he was now running a large company, he kept making bold moves that I don't think anybody else would have done. For a while, there was some evidence, or at least hope, that he had tempered his personal style, that facing cancer and turning 50 had caused him to be a bit less brutish when he was upset. Right after he came back from his operation, he didn't do the humiliation bit as much, Tavanian recalled. If he was displeased, he might scream and get hopping mad and use expletives, but he wouldn't do it in a way that would totally destroy the person he was talking to. It was just his way to get the person to do a better job. Tavanian reflected for a moment as he said this, then added a caveat. Unless he thought someone was really bad and had to go, which happened every once in a while. Eventually, however, the rough edges returned. Because most of his colleagues were used to it by then and had learned to cope, what upset them most was when his ire turned on strangers. Once we went to a Whole Foods market to get a smoothie, Ive recalled, and this older woman was making it, and he really got on her about how she was doing it. Then later, he sympathized. She's an older woman and doesn't want to be doing this job. He didn't connect the two. He was being a purist in both cases. On a trip to London with Jobs, Ive had the thankless task of choosing the hotel. He picked the Hempel, a tranquil 5-star boutique hotel with a sophisticated minimalism that he thought Jobs would love. But as soon as they checked in, he braced himself, and sure enough, his phone rang a minute later. "I hate my room," Jobs declared. "It's a piece of shit. Let's go." So Ive gathered his luggage and went to the front desk, where Jobs bluntly told the shocked clerk what he thought. Ive realized that most people, himself among them, tend not to be direct when they feel something is shoddy because they want to be liked, which is actually a vain trait. That was an overly kind explanation. In any case, it was not a trait Jobs had. Because Ive was so instinctively nice, he puzzled over why Jobs, whom he deeply liked, behaved as he did. One evening in a San Francisco bar, he leaned forward with an earnest intensity and tried to analyze it. "He's a very, very sensitive guy. That's one of the things that makes his antisocial behavior, his rudeness, so unconscionable. I can understand why people who are thick-skinned and unfeeling can be rude, but not sensitive people." I once asked him why he gets so mad about stuff. He said, "But I don't stay mad." He has this very childish ability to get really worked up about something, and it doesn't stay with him at all. But there are other times, I think honestly, when he's very frustrated, and his way to achieve catharsis is to hurt somebody. And I think he feels he has a liberty and a license to do that. The normal rules of social engagement, he feels, don't apply to him. Because of how very sensitive he is, he knows exactly how to efficiently and effectively hurt someone, and he does do that. Every now and then, a wise colleague would pull Jobs aside to try to get him to settle down. Lee Clow was a master. "Steve, can I talk to you?" he would quietly say when Jobs had belittled someone publicly. He would go into Jobs' office and explain how hard everyone was working. "When you humiliate them, It's more debilitating than stimulating, he said in one such session. Jobs would apologize and say he understood, but then he would lapse again. It's simply who I am, he would say. One thing that did mellow was his attitude toward Bill Gates. Microsoft had kept its end of the bargain it made in 1997 when it agreed to continue developing great software for the Macintosh. Plus, it was becoming less relevant as a competitor, having failed thus far to replicate Apple's digital hub strategy. Gates and Jobs had very different approaches to products and innovation, but their rivalry had produced in each a surprising self-awareness. For their All Things Digital conference in May 2007, the Wall Street Journal columnists Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher worked to get them together for a joint interview. Mossberg first invited Jobs, who didn't go to many such conferences, and was surprised when he said he would do it if Gates would. On hearing that, Gates accepted as well. Mossberg wanted the evening joint appearance to be a cordial discussion, not a debate, but that seemed less likely when Jobs unleashed a swipe at Microsoft during a solo interview earlier that day. Asked about the fact that Apple's iTunes software for Windows computers was extremely popular, Jobs joked, "It's like giving a glass of ice water to somebody in hell." So when it was time for Gates and Jobs to meet in the green room before their joint session that evening, Mossberg was worried. Gates got there first, with his aide Larry Cohen, who had briefed him about Jobs's remark earlier that day. When Jobs ambled in a few minutes later, he grabbed a bottle of water from the ice bucket and sat down. After a moment or two of silence, Gates said, "So, I guess I'm the representative from hell." He wasn't smiling. Jobs paused, gave him one of his impish grins, and handed him the ice water. Gates relaxed, and the tension dissipated. The result was a fascinating duet in which each wunderkind of the digital age spoke warily and then warmly about the other. Most memorably, they gave candid answers when the technology strategist, Lise Beyer, who was in the audience, asked what each had learned from observing the other. "Well, I'd give a lot to have Steve's taste," Gates answered. There was a bit of nervous laughter. Jobs had famously said 10 years earlier that his problem with Microsoft was that it had absolutely no taste. But Gates insisted he was serious. Jobs was a natural in terms of intuitive taste. He recalled how he and Jobs used to sit together reviewing the software that Microsoft was making for the Macintosh. "I'd see Steve make the decision based on a sense of people and product that, you know, is hard for me to explain. The way he does things is just different, and I think it's magical. And in that case, wow." Jobs stared at the floor. Later, he told me that he was blown away by how honest and gracious Gates had just been. Jobs was equally honest, though not quite as gracious when his turn came. He described the great divide between the Apple theology of building end-to-end integrated products and Microsoft's openness to licensing its software to competing hardware makers. In the music market, the integrated approach, as manifested in his iTunes iPod package, was proving to be the better, he noted, but Microsoft's decoupled approach was faring better in the personal computer market. One question he raised in an offhand way was, which approach might work better for mobile phones? Then he went on to make an insightful point. This difference in design philosophy, he said, led him and Apple to be less good at collaborating with other companies. Because Woz and I started the company based on doing the whole banana, we weren't so good at partnering with people, he said. And I think if Apple could have had a little more of that in its DNA, it would have served it extremely well.